And now, for our feature presentation. Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents Don Pendleton's The Executioner. Narrated by Jeff Baker. With performances by Terrence Aselford, Nanette Savard, Richard Rowan, Karen Carbone, David Coyne, Ken Jackson, James Konacek, and Mort Shelby. The Executioner, number 314, Lethal Payload.
Death to the United States!
The words were venomous, but the executioner had heard them before, all too often.
Death to the United States! Death to the United States!
Olin's canoe slid through the rollers and crunched to a halt in the sand. He stepped into the foam of the Java Sea and dragged the outrigger out of the surf and onto land. The beach was a patchwork of grays, greens, and blacks in his night vision goggles.
Death to the United States!
Olin smiled grimly. The panda car was in fine form.
Death to the great Satan!
Olin shook his head. The mullah was not willing to be outdone. The executioner was wary of rescue missions. They threw every single advantage into the hands of his opponents. He was always outnumbered, always outgunned, and savvy enemies always had multiple opportunities to kill their captives or use them as human shields. Olin was always in dire risk of killing those he had come to save. The fact was that in the past 2 years, hostage rescues in the Pacific had not all gone according to plan. American and Australian rescue missions in the Philippines and Indonesia had garnered only dead hostages. It seemed as if fate dealt from the bottom of the deck and gave all the high cards to the ghouls. It was the same old situation. Olin was one man, and he held but a single card. It was known as surprise. It trumped everything, and there was nothing sweeter when it was used at its best. Olin wasted no time as he marched up the beach. Pandakars were master teachers of Pencak Silat, the national martial arts of the Indonesian archipelago. Along with the great technical skills they developed, they were renowned spiritualists, famed for their supernatural powers, rumored to include telepathy, mystic healing, and clairvoyance. They were thought to be invulnerable. Pandakar bin Pajar Riga was a master of the Jokuk style and was considered by his followers to be a mystic. When the Taliban mullah Abu Hamid al-Jawani had fled Afghanistan during Operation Anaconda, Ragag had welcomed the refugee mullah as a divine sign. Al-Jawani's teachings of jihad against the United States had been welcomed and were taken on with religious fervor by Ragag and his followers. Olin moved quickly through the thin jungle. A two-story hut dominated the clearing. A number of smaller huts arced out on either side of the big house in a horseshoe shape. A bonfire burned in the middle. Beside the fire, a pair of posts had been sunk in the soil, and Famke Riesemus was strung between them. She was a famous European fashion model who came to Java annually to help her uncle with his missionary work. That was enough to make her a target of the Pandakar. Olin could see she was bruised and her blonde hair was disheveled, but there was no obvious blood or serious wound yet. The real punishment was yet to come. A half-naked man leaped into the sand near Resimus. He wore only a red turban and a white breech clout tied with a red sash around his hips. Foam flecked his lips. His wiry musculature stood out in high relief as his hips and shoulders jerked with the drumbeats. He tossed away his AK-47 rifle. The cries of the mob rose as he reached both hands into his sash and withdrew two Javanese kreis. The sinuous handles of the daggers were carved into the shapes of dragons. He reversed the 12-inch undulating blades in his hands. His eyes glazed over as he aimed the quick silver weapons at his chest. Sweat streamed down his torso in rivulets. He stabbed both blades into his own chest. Roughly 40 people formed a circle around the fire. Rigog and Al-Jawani sat on raised divans. A half dozen men sat cross-legged in the sand at their feet. The rest of the gathering stood swaying. All carried bladed weapons, and most also clutched rifles, pistols, or submachine guns. Many in the throng were working themselves into a trance like that of the dancer. The dancer stabbed himself again. The blades stuck between his ribs. No blood ran down the dancer's sides. A man in a trance was said to be unstoppable. Bolin had faced opponents armed with mystical powers on more than one occasion. Around the globe, martial artists and mystics used rigorous training, ritual, and special breathing techniques to manipulate their personal energy and aspects of the autonomous nervous system that were on autopilot in most humans. Such people were capable of almost inhuman feats. But most mystical fighting had been rendered obsolete in a modern world of high-capacity automatic rifles and helicopter gunships. Bolin did not believe in magic, but he had long ago learned not to sneer at sorcerers. Bolin considered the M16 he held. If he opened up with his rifle, the mob would blindly, suicidally rush him, and he would fall beneath their knives before he managed to empty his magazine, much less reload. Bolin had other ideas. The dancer turned on Resimus. He raised his knives overhead like ice picks. Bolin reached beneath his rifle and slipped his finger around the trigger of the FN-303 less lethal launcher mounted under the forestock. He flicked off the safety and his thumb pressed down. The laser sight came to life and put a red spot on the knife-wielding dancer's chest. It was time to see exactly how much control over his autonomous circulatory system the dancer really had. The FN-303 was a glorified paintball gun that fired fin-stabilized 68 caliber projectiles. They were designed to hit the target like a fist and break on contact to prevent penetration. They were unlikely to stop a highly trained martial artist, much less one in self-induced trance. Bolin's rounds had been custom loaded to unique specifications, however. The executioner squeezed the trigger three times in rapid succession. The dancer stopped at the impacts, but did not fall. For a second, his glazed eyes narrowed as he searched the crowd for his attacker. No one in the mob even noticed. The dancer's legs suddenly wobbled, and his knives fell from his hands. The music subsided as the dancer staggered. He took three rapid steps toward his master, then fell, clutching his belly. The dancer vomited all over the Pandakar. Bolin's projectiles were rear-loaded with Atomsite, which had another more colloquial nickname, vomit gas. The dancer collapsed in the Pandakar's lap, convulsing violently. Bolin began squeezing the trigger of the launcher repeatedly as he moved the laser sight from target to target. The projectiles carried only small loads of the irritant, but as the stunned Javanese milled and tried to help one another, the effects spread like wildfire. The soldier swiftly loaded another 15-round cassette of projectiles and resumed firing. Total surprise had been exploited. The entire mob was down or in the process of falling prey to the nauseating vapors. Bamka Resimus strained against her bonds. She was seemingly surrounded by a 10-foot halo in the sand. Everyone outside the circle Bolan had drawn lay in their own personal intestinal hell, part of the greater sea of writhing fanatics. But Bolan could not hold off an army with only Adamson. He had to get in and get out. There were others on the island, and it was only a matter of seconds before the situation would turn deadly. Bolan pulled on his gas mask and strode out of the trees. A man staggered into Bolan's path, brandishing a razor-sharp panga. Tears streamed down his cheeks as he raised the heavy knife over his head. Bleeding but alive, the attacker collapsed unconscious on the sand. Bolan moved into the circle. He turned and scooped up a fallen knife. Rissimus collapsed into his arms as he cut her bonds. The soldier leaned toward her ear and shouted through his gas mask.
Close your eyes. Hold your breath.
He lifted her over his shoulder and picked his way back through the heaving throng in the sand. He cleared the gas area and yanked up his mask as he set the woman down.
Are you all right?
She swayed on her feet. Her beautiful blue eyes were as wide as dinner plates. She looked at Bolan like a deer in the headlights.
Where's your uncle?
My uncle? Oh, they tortured him. Oh my God, he's doing the big hot.
Bolan took the woman's wrist and pulled her into the trees outside the semicircle of huts. She stared in dull horror as he drew his Beretta 93R and shoved it into her hands.
Stay here. Hold the gun in both hands. I've put it on semi-automatic. Point it and pull the trigger on anyone besides me or your uncle. I'll be right back.
Bolan shoved her down into the bushes and ran through the trees. He skirted the outer perimeter of the horseshoe-shaped village and made for the rear of the biggest hut, which was built on a raised platform of logs. The beams of the structure were solid, but the walls were made of densely woven lengths of split bamboo. Three men with rifles spilled out of the hut and ran down the steps toward the fallen mob. Bolan stayed in the shadows. He crept around the building and stopped at the edge of the veranda. A man stood with his rifle shouldered, watching the other men run into the circle of writhing bodies. Bolan watched as well. The men ran and knelt beside their stricken comrades. Within seconds, they were doubled over, contorting with nausea. The man on the veranda stayed put, tracking his rifle for a target. Suddenly, the man turned toward Bolan. The laser sight of the executioner's weapon system put a red dot on the rifleman's head. Bolan vaulted onto the veranda, but he stopped at the door. Every instinct screamed danger.
Let me down, you vile Rondon!
Bolan kept his body behind the heavy teak beam framing the doorway as he spoke slowly.
Let Peter Rissimus go now, and I'll let you live.
Preacher man gonna die, G.I. Throw down your gun. My boy come pick it up and maybe we talk.
Bolan drew the 9mm Centennial hammerless revolver from his ankle holster and tucked it into the back of his belt. He pulled his pant leg back over the empty holster and stood. He tossed the assault rifle through the door.
All right!
Bolan stepped into the doorway. The hut was a meeting place. The vast majority of the floor was woven grass matting where people sat and received instruction. A small elevated platform near the back with a pair of cushions marked where the Pandakar and the Mullahs held court. A section of the matting was pulled away, revealing a hatch in the floor that led to a cellar. A Javanese man stood in the stairway leading down. He wore a red turban and was bare-chested and heavily muscled. He held an AK-74 rifle with the buttstock folded and the bayonet fixed. Bolan assessed the situation. The man was an amateur, but he was armed with an automatic rifle, and the range was 5 meters. The man stared at Bolan's weapon where it lay, and then at the empty holster on Bolan's thigh.
Pistol, asshole.
Bolan kept his hands open and down by his hips.
I gave it to Famke.
The man sneered and stepped out of the stairwell.
Where are your Australian SAS friends?
Bolan had immense respect for the Australian SAS, but they were on the Indian Ocean side of Java and had chosen the wrong island. When Bolan's intel told him where the bad guys were, he hadn't had time to wait.
I'm alone.
American cowboy asshole.
Bolan remained silent. The man gave Boland's weapon an appreciative look and kicked it into a far corner of the room. In a split second, Boland's hand was behind his back. He twisted and shoved the snub-nosed Smith & Wesson forward in a fencer's lunge. The kidnapper raised his rifle, but Boland was already in motion. He aimed and squeezed the trigger. A voice floated up from the cellar below.
Diwankara! Diwankara!
Diwankara's dead.
Boland crossed the matting and reclaimed his rifle. He crouched by the hatchway.
And so are you, unless Peter Reasonless walks up those stairs now.
There's a man injured!
So carry him, like your life depended on it.
Boland took a fragmentation grenade from his belt and pulled the pin. He retained the grenade with his fingers clamped on the cotter lever. He tossed the pin down the stairs and listened to it clink on the steps. He took a moment to let that sink in.
Dutch intelligence and the Australians want the missionaries. You come up right now and bring Peter Reasonless with you, alive, or you'll join Diwankara.
Waiting for the response, Boland monitored the noises outside. Adamsite was a persistent gas, and its effects lasted for hours, but the island was several kilometers in diameter, and he by no means had control of it.
I come up!
Do it slow.
Peter Reasonless appeared in the hatchway. Boland stayed stone-faced as the missionary staggered up the steps. He was a tall man, but his upper body listed in an ugly fashion from a broken collarbone. He was missing several fingers, and his body was covered with burns, bruises, and wounds. The missionary had been tortured by those who had given in to their hatred. They had maimed the old man for the pleasure it had given them. There was a Swedish Carl Gustav submachine gun pressed to the old man's temple. The kidnapper stood behind the Dutchman, using his prisoner as a shield. He held Reasonless's injured arm cruelly twisted behind his back. Most of the terrorist was hidden behind the missionary's body. His eyes glared over the top of his weapon, and he wore a red turban like the rest of his sect. Tattoos crawled up the corded muscles of his forearms. Reasonless flinched as the gun muzzle was rammed even harder into his skull. The terrorist smiled and revealed missing teeth.
Drop your gun, G.I.
The laser sight on Boland's carbine clicked on with pressure from his hand, and a red dot appeared just below the kidnapper's turban.
Drop yours!
The man's hand whitened on the grip of the submachine gun.
Drop your gun!
Boland frowned and lowered his rifle slightly. The terrorist grinned. He did not notice the red laser dot came to rest on his gun hand.
Now, G.I., you...
The Swedish submachine gun fell from the shredded remnants of the terrorist's hand. Reasonless fell from his grip as the kidnapper's eyes widened in horror at the sight of his wound. The expression became his death mask. As his kidnapper's body vanished into the cellar, Peter Reasonless collapsed on the floor. Boland moved swiftly down the stairs. The terrorist lay sprawled in the lower chamber. Bloodstains on the floor and the fetid air of human suffering attested to what the lower room had been used for. Boland found the pin from his grenade and replaced it. He scanned the room swiftly and took several maps, documents, and a cell phone. He knelt beside the dead man and peered at his arm intently. Among the writhing tribal tattoos was a distinctive shield, an Asiatic dragon coiled across the background. Superimposed over the dragon was a very Western-looking cartoon owl. Above the owl was a tiny stylized parachute canopy. The dead man was also wearing dog tags. Boland memorized the tattoo. He snapped the dog tags from around the man's neck and took the knife that was sheathed in his sash.
Frumke?
She's safe. She's waiting for us. Sir, can you walk?
I prayed to God for salvation, and you came.
He clasped Boland with his good arm and struggled to rise. Boland had to do most of the work to get Reasonless on his feet, but the old man steadied himself and nodded.
But God also helps those who help themselves, and I will walk from this place. I do not know if I can run. That gun on the ground, it is Swedish.
Boland scooped up the weapon.
Can you shoot?
I was a soldier in the army before I became a soldier of God.
The missionary slung the weapon over his good shoulder and took the grip in his hand. He looked back down the stairs at his torturer.
And we are among men who have fallen from the grace of any God I know. I will pray for their souls later.
Bolin nodded. Missionary life was hard. They often went where disease, poverty, and human suffering were at their absolute worst. The executioner had only to look in the old man's eyes to know he was about as tough as they came.
This is Stryker. I have the package. I'm extracting.
Helicopters are coming?
I have a canoe. Come on. We have a submarine to catch.
Bolin collapsed into a chair in the heart of the Stony Man complex. Aaron the Bear Kurtzman smiled as he approached the executioner.
Well, if it isn't the hero of the hour, that was about as slick a rescue op as has ever been done. One for the textbooks. Whew, an Adam's light gun. Whew, gives me the heebie-jeebies just thinking about it. The cowboy's a sick man.
Bolin stared into the distance, distracted.
I hear a certain supermodel was suitably grateful.
Bolin frowned slightly, but not at Kurtzman.
What's bothering you?
The soldier glanced at the sketch he had made.
Did you make anything of the tattoo and the dog tags?
A little. Why?
That guy was in command.
Huh. What about Ragog and Al-Jawani?
It was their show, but the guy in the cellar was in command, at least tactically, and he wasn't part of the ceremony. He was wearing a red turban. He was Javanese. He may have been Muslim, and he was definitely more than just another member of the Pandikar sect.
Really? How so?
I don't know. His vibe. He didn't act like some fanatic on guard duty who was missing out on the show of a lifetime. He was far too cool. If he was part of the congregation, he should have come up out of the cellar in berserker mode, foaming at the mouth with 2 feet of steel in each hand. Instead, he starts making like an FBI negotiator. I don't think the riflemen he sent out were part of the party either. I wish I'd had time to check them out. What'd you get on the sketch I gave you and the dog tags?
The tags were simple enough. We got his name, Pak Wijahartani, and his serial number, which implies to me that he at least made sergeant.
You think he's Indonesian Army?
I would, except that at the top of the tags are the letters L.E., Légion Étrangère.
You think our boy is French Foreign Legion?
I'm betting he was. I'm running what I can on his dog tags now, but I don't think I can get much without actually trying to break into Legion records, and I'd like to try and go the legitimate route first. We do not want to officially piss off the French Foreign Legion. But I doubt very much your pal was acting in any official Legion capacity when you met him.
How about the tattoo?
Yeah, that I don't know. Some kind of insignia? I couldn't find anything exactly like it in any open military databases, but soldiers have been giving themselves unofficial unit or specific mission patches and insignia since the French and Indian Wars. If this is a Legion insignia, I bet it's an unofficial one and not tolerated on any formal uniform dress. I suspect it's a custom job. Probably has to do with his company's special role or mission. Assuming, of course, that he didn't have it done when he was in the Indonesian Army and then joined the Legion later. A fair number of Legionnaires are veterans of other services. I'm running a check to see if his name or the insignia pops up on any Indonesian or Asian military database we have, but so far we haven't turned up anything. Of course, people who join the Legion are allowed to change their names and often do, so the one on the tag may not be the one his daddy gave him.
Any other good news?
Yeah, it's a tattoo. He could have made the damn thing up when he was drunk.
Bear, what would you make of it?
Best guess? The dragon could mean anything, though if I had to bet, it probably has something to do with service in Asia. The owl might mean some kind of night operations. It's a specialization in the Legion. The parachute's a no-brainer. Your boy was airborne, and in the French Foreign Legion, the paratroops are the elite.
Kurtzman wasn't telling Bolin much he didn't already know, but he was confirming his suspicions. The computer wizard stared at the sketch again.
These guys could be mercs. It's not unknown for guys to get out of the Foreign Legion and go to work for someone else. Legionnaire certainly has some prestige attached to it. Maybe the Mullah felt that he needed some extra muscle with the United States and Australia hunting him.
Hmm. He already had an island full of muscle with the Pandakar and his boys. Both men were also very religious. Al-Juwanayi is Taliban, and Ragag is part of the Al-Qaeda cell network in Indonesia. Neither organization is known for hiring outsiders. These guys are definitely part of the puzzle.
Okay, but making them fit isn't going to be any fun.
Bolin was all too aware of that. He trusted his instincts, but there were no facts to back them up or leads to take them anywhere.
What about the cell phone and the documents I collected on the island?
Kurtzman's monitor showed Carmen Delahunt rapidly pounding the keyboard at her workstation. She looked up and blew a lock of red hair away from her eyes.
What's up, Aaron?
Stryker's here, and he's hoping for some answers. Got any?
Just a moment. The cell phone's memory had some numbers in it. Several were to Jakarta, and not surprisingly, they were to phones that were stolen. One led to Bali, and again dead-ended to a stolen phone. One anomaly was a number that led to French Guiana, which, as you can guess, dead-ended.
The French Foreign Legion has its jungle warfare school in French Guiana. Bear, I want a country study, now.
A map of South America popped up on the screen. Information began scrolling. They read an encyclopedia-like description of the French colony. Bolin stared hard at the map inset on the screen.
What kind of transnational issues are we looking at?
Very few. They're always asking for increasing autonomy from France, but in public votes, only a small percentage of the population supports seceding from France, and they're not a violent faction. Their neighbor, Suriname, claims a strip of their territory between the River Litani and the River Moroni, but it's never come to a military struggle. There is limited illicit marijuana growing along the coast, but that's mostly for local consumption. Interpol considers them to be a minor drug transshipment point to Europe at best. Unemployment is a problem, but not monumental.
What's the Muslim population?
Minuscule, not enough to register in official population charts. French Guiana is overwhelmingly Roman Catholic. The Muslim community are immigrants and most likely to be businessmen or university-educated professionals working for French companies.
His map tracked westward, and information scrolled.
Suriname, however, does have a significant Muslim population.
From Java.
Bingo. Suriname was a former Dutch colony, just like Indonesia, and the Dutch imported a lot of Javanese for labor. But that still doesn't get us anywhere. The Javanese are in Suriname, and there are almost none to speak of in French Guiana. That's a non-issue.
But Pack had a contact there.
He called a phone number there. There are two tiny countries on the northern tip of South America, and it's a small world.
Pack was Al-Qaeda. They don't do anything small. He was on a mission, a high-profile kidnapping and murder, and he had presets in his cell phone. Those would all be important contact numbers. One of them was in French Guiana.
Well, it's intriguing, I'll grant you. But how are you going to string this all together into anything significant is beyond me.
I'm not. You are.
You know, I knew you were going to say that. How do you want to play it?
Suriname has a significant Muslim population, predominantly Javanese, and Ragag was a Jokuk stylist, heavy into religion and mysticism. And now it looks like at least some splinter sect of it has gone militant. Do whatever you have to find any practice of Jokuk-style Pintyak Salat in Suriname. Find a connection, no matter how tenuous, and then make it lead to French Guiana.
This is getting thin, Stryker. I trust you and your instincts, but we are officially grasping at straws.
I know. But I know you, Bear. You've worked with a lot less.
You keep talking like that and you're going to have a date for the prom.
Here's the part where you lose that love and feeling.
You want Karen me to hack the French Foreign Legion's military records. Stryker, if you're accepted into the Legion and want to change your identity and get away from your past, they do everything in their power to help you. This is the kind of info they're going to keep protected. You know what kind of a stink it's going to raise if we get caught breaking into their military databases?
So, don't get caught.
Oh, geez, Stryker, hacking France is like...
Keep it mission specific. Find Pak Widjahartani if you can, and any other aliases he might have. Find out where he's from and where he's been. If he was a legionnaire, find out what regiment he served in and where. Other than that specific info, no sightseeing. Don't download anything else France or the Legion would find sensitive, but I have got to find Pack.
All right. I'll lay out a battle plan for Akira, pull up our French translator programs. I can't even begin to imagine what kind of operating system and safeguards the French Foreign Legion is using. But I'll start on the assumption it's using the same protection of information protocols as the regular French military. I'll have Carmen download and collate every useful piece of information on the Legion that she can find and get a copy made for us. The Legion's one of the most colorful military units in the history of mankind, and it should make interesting reading on the plane. I'm assuming you're getting on a plane?
Yeah. Ugh. But I need a nap. I'm going to take 24 hours downtime. Then I want to meet with you again to see what we have. Assuming it's anything, I'll need Barbara to arrange a flight to Suriname. I'll need an updated passport and a French visa, and get me a full warload delivered to the U.S. Embassy down there.
I'm on it.
Okay. I'm sacking out. As soon as you have that information package on the Legion, call me.
One thing, Stryker.
What's that?
You be careful about messing in Legion business. They're known for killing people who mess with them.
I've heard that. And I'll be careful. Now, get me some results, Bear. I know you can do it.
Bolin removed the bandage and surveyed the handiwork on his arm. It would have to do. Sweat stung his arm as he stepped out from the air-conditioned hotel, and his shirt soaked through from the 90-degree heat and the matching humidity. Suriname sat at the top of South America, less than 200 kilometers from the equator. As a nation, Suriname consisted almost totally of its coastal strip, and once one strolled half a kilometer from the surf and sand, the sea breeze ended, and the cloistered heat of the tropical rainforest began. The capital city followed the geography. The Europeans clung to the coast. Modern European Dutch-style businesses and homes clustered along the beaches and the waterfronts of the capital. Once one went inland, the tin shacks of the ever-growing ghettos clawed space out of the jungle. Bolin put the blissful breeze of the sea to his back and walked into the blast furnace. He was walking into a part of the capital that most people avoided after dark, and where police went only when heavily armed and in strong numbers. Bolin got the directions from the U.S. Embassy, but he could have followed his nose. It was evening, and with the setting of the sun, the act of cooking had become tolerable. Bolin walked the invisible borders of the shanty towns by scent and turned to follow the aroma of jasmine rice, curry, and simmering coconut milk to the Javanese quarter. Bolin had few illusions. He was barely armed, and his ruse was as thin as hell. He would not be able to withstand more than the lightest scrutiny, and if it came to a fight, he would never live to reload the little .22 Walther PPKS tucked in the small of his back. The knife tucked in his boot would be of even less use against men who had spent their lives practicing with foot-long kris knives and parangs. People sat outside on the stoops and rattan chairs, taking their ease, or leaned out the windows to try to catch some hint of the evening breeze. They smoked cigarettes and looked sidelong at Bolin with undisguised suspicion as he passed. Bolin consulted his mental map and approached the practice hall of Pandikar Ali Sorho. Sorho was a Pandikar of high repute of the Jokuk style, from the same lineage as Rigog. In this confrontation, Bolin would not have tactical surprise or atomsite gas to back him up against this mystic warrior and his circle. The hall was a World War II vintage Quonset hut that had been repaired many times. Tin siding had been used to patch the walls and the roof. Woven rattan screens covered the windows. The scent of sandalwood incense drifted from an open door that was obscured by hanging strings of kola nut beads. Two men sat on the stoop, smoking pipes with incredibly long stems. They wore t-shirts, shorts, and sandals, and looked like everyone else in the quarter seeking relief from the evening heat. The veins crawling across their corded, rock-hewn forearms and calloused hands bespoke of long weapons training with blades and staves. The two men watched Bolin approach with feigned disinterest. When Bolin came within a few feet, the two men suddenly rose with fluid grace. They flared out heavily developed shoulders and stood in his way like temple guardians carved of stone. Bolin smiled, but the smile he gave them was very sad, as if he were in mourning. He bowed his head toward both men respectfully.
Assalamu alaikum.
The two sentries blinked in surprise as Boland greeted them in Arabic. They bowed back, but their wary eyes were still hooded like hawks considering prey.
What do you want?
I need to speak with Pandakar Sorho. One of us is fallen.
Boland took out the knife he had liberated from Pak Wujihartani's corpse in Indonesia. Wujihartani's legion dog tags were wrapped around the hilt. The two men sucked in their breath in dismay. The taller one surveyed Boland intensely.
And you?
Boland pulled up his sleeve. His arm still burned where the tattoo had been scrawled into his skin. The tattoo was not deep, but direct injections of cortisone had been required to get rid of the swelling. The CIA-developed inks would dissolve within a matter of days. The job had been done by a former Navy SEAL who owned his own tattoo parlor and commissioned tattoos needed by agents going undercover. The man was a pro, and even though the tattoo was less than 48 hours old, it looked like Boland had borne it for years. The tattoo was of a shield. A dragon was scrawled across its background, and a stylized owl parachuted across the front of it. The sentry stared at the tattoo and nodded slowly. The taller one took the knife from Boland and motioned for him to follow them inside. The scent of sandalwood was very strong. The walls were covered with crossed spears and staves. Short swords and knives with blades that curved in every possible direction were everywhere. Batik prints of gods, heroes, and demons covered the patched steel walls. The incense sticks near the altar had burned low. The evening's instruction was over. Two men swept the floor, and another dusted the altar. Ali Sorho sat cross-legged on a mat. Boland scrutinized the Pandakar carefully as he unfolded his legs and seemed to grow out of the mat like a tree. He was a slightly built man who looked to be around 50. Boland knew that looks could be quite deceiving in martial arts masters. Sorho could be anywhere from 50 to 70. To have reached the rank of Pandakar, his slight build and gentle features hid his power like silken cloth wrapped around an iron dagger. The taller of the men escorting Boland approached the Pandakar and bowed deeply. He leaned in close to his master and whispered to him for long moments before presenting him with the knife Boland had brought. Sorho accepted the weapon reverently and went to lay it upon the altar. His man and the two men sweeping fell into rank behind the Pandakar as he approached Boland. The man dusting the altar ceased his cleaning and pulled out a cell phone. Boland bowed low to the Pandakar. The master bowed back.
You speak Arabic?
I am only just learning to further my studies of the Holy Quran.
The Pandakar nodded at Boland's wisdom.
You knew Pak?
Boland pulled false Foreign Legion dog tags up from around his neck.
We served together in the Legion. It was there that I converted to Islam.
The man with the cell phone clicked it shut and went back to his dusting. Boland noted he was working back the way he had just come and was putting himself between Boland and the door. The Pandakar gestured at the knife and the dog tags on the altar.
How did you come by these effects?
How much have you been told? There was an attack. Pak and his men were overcome and killed. We believe it was done by special forces, most likely Australian SAS. We believe we were betrayed from within.
Boland's face was stony as he openly scrutinized the men before him. One of the disciples flinched as he met the soldier's tombstone stare. The big man had come looking for a traitor. It was very clear that he did not consider them above suspicion.
How much have you been told?
Only Key has been...
Where is Key?
He was short, but had almost inhumanly wide shoulders. He was naked, save for shorts and sandals. Every muscle in his body stood out in high relief, as did numerous scars, some of which Boland recognized as bullet and shrapnel wounds. Tattoos crawled along his biceps and shoulders. Both the man's physique and the way he carried himself were reminiscent of a brutal and battle-hardened Bruce Lee. The two men measured each other. Boland was relieved that the man did not sport the owl and dragon tattoo. The man wore round French military dog tags. Boland nodded at him. Key looked at the sheathed kris and the dog tags on the altar. He then stared long and hard at Bolin's tattoo.
You served with Pak?
Bolin threw caution to the wind.
We met in the Pacific. I was in the 5th Foreign Regiment. I spent most of my time at Fantagatofa and a number of the other atolls.
It was a wild gamble. The 5th Foreign Regiment had been stationed in support of France's nuclear testing in the South Pacific. Their activities had great political sensitivity, and the regiment had since been dissolved. Their top secret duties and subsequent disbandment allowed Bolin to make up almost any kind of story. The Achilles heel of the ruse was that French-owned atolls were tiny communities, the communities of the Legionnaires even tinier. If Key had served in the same theater, Bolin was doomed. Key watched Bolin like a hawk as he digested Bolin's story.
Now, how much have you been told?
Key never stopped trying to read Bolin's eyes. He looked down at the tattoo on Bolin's arm once more.
I do not know you. This will require verification.
Of course. I'm going to give you a telephone number.
He reached slowly into his shirt pocket and pulled out a small pad and fountain pen.
Memorize it and destroy it.
Bolin flipped open the pad and turned the pen over. Suddenly, he pressed the pocket clip. The pen shot a stream of pressurized CS tear gas directly into the Pandakar's eyes. Bolin flicked the notebook into Key's face as the Pandakar staggered back into his disciples. The blow had no impact, but Key brought his hands up to cover his eyes. Bolin put his thumb on the butt end of the pen and thrust the blunt object into Key's esophagus. Bolin jumped to put Key between himself and the rest of the disciples. Blades appeared in their hands. With his free hand, Bolin ripped the dog tags from around Key's neck. The man by the door ripped a rattan staff from the wall. The executioner emptied the rest of his gas pen at the men surrounding the Pandakar and broke for freedom as they flinched. Bolin broke sideways and ran at a dead sprint for the eastern wall of the hut. He chose a rusty-looking 5-foot section of tin siding that had been used to patch a hole in the ancient structure and hit it like a fullback. He rolled in the muck of the alley and came up running. The soldier could guess what they were yelling to the barrio around them at large.
Stop him!
A man rose from a stoop and raised his hands as he stepped into Bolin's path. The executioner ripped him off his feet with a forearm shiver without breaking stride. People were coming out of their houses. The big American did not look back, but he could hear a mob swiftly forming behind him. The road ahead began to fill with alarmed citizens. Bolin drew his pistol as he ran, raised the gun in the air, and fired off 3 quick rounds. The people ahead of Bolin parted like the Red Sea, but the angry mob was undeterred. There was only one option, and that was to run. Bolin retraced his path. It wasn't the quickest way out of the quarter, but it was his safest bet. He knew furious phone calls were crisscrossing, trying to arrange solid resistance ahead to cut him off. Bolin held up his gun to deter anyone who appeared before him. His heart hammered in his chest as he used his size and speed to put distance between himself and the ever-increasing mob chasing him. Bolin caught the scent of cayenne pepper as his lungs heaved. He pushed himself into an all-out sprint toward the smell. A pair of dark-skinned men looked up in surprise as he charged past them. Bolin burst into the Creole quarter. He had no friends here, but neither did the Japanese. He raced across a footbridge and tossed his pistol and holster into the canal below. A gun would not help him here. Creoles began coming out of their houses to see what the ruckus was about. Many of them carried machetes loosely in their hands. Bolin ducked down a side alley and quickly lost himself in the maze. He slowed to a walk and let his breathing return to normal. He was still in a dangerous part of town, and he did not expect any Creole to protect him out of Christian charity. But the 5,000 Dutch guilders he carried in his belt could buy a great deal of generosity, and probably an anonymous ride back to the embassy as well. Bolin held up his prize. The dog tags he had taken from Key glittered dully in the dim light. It was time to give Kurtzman something to do. Key clutched his bruised throat. He snapped a phone out of the hand of a subordinate.
Put me through. Buck has been compromised.
How so?
They had his dog tags. They followed the trail here. They know he was a legionnaire. The man took my dog tags and escaped with him.
Well now, that is an unfortunate turn of events. So, just for my edification, this man came in, claiming to be a legionnaire, and then defeated you, the Pandekar, your friends, stole your dog tags, and ran off into the night with them?
Yes. That is about the size of it.
Tell me, where did he go? I assume you mounted some sort of pursuit?
We did. We chased him for some distance through the streets, but he was lightning fast. His attack at the Pandekars was sudden and unorthodox, as was his escape. He is obviously some kind of professional.
Do you believe he is a legionnaire?
I do not know. The way he acted, it was clear he is a very experienced soldier. Things like that cannot be faked. Whether he served with Pak in Polynesia, without a name, that would be very hard to verify, with the unwanted attention it could attract.
That is true, but in your opinion, is he a legionnaire?
He has the dog tags, but I did not get to see them up close. He had the same tattoo as Pak and others who served as security in the atolls. But my instincts tell me no. I do not believe he is Legion.
That is all I need to hear you say.
So what do we do?
Let us assume your instincts are correct, and he is American. To my knowledge, the United States has no military or intelligence assets in Suriname to speak of. The only real place it can take genuine sanctuary or receive any sort of aid is the American Embassy. If he has reached the embassy, he will be able to contact his confederate stateside. With your dog tags in his possession, it will only be a matter of time before they determine who you are.
What do you propose we do?
Tell the Pandekar to gather men he trusts. Cover the embassy now, 24 hours a day. Sooner or later, he must come out. When he does, you and your men will kill him. I will send Cigarette and Babar to back you up, but you will lead. And you and the Pandekar's men must see to finishing the job. If you fail, then whatever kind of stink rises up, it must be a Javanese stink, and one that ends in Suriname.
Key looked at the weapons mounted on the walls. They would be of little use in the coming confrontation. It was the crated weapons beneath the cellar that would tell the tale now.
If he somehow escapes us?
If he somehow escapes and learns your identity, then he will most certainly come here. And then I will most certainly kill him.
At the Suriname U.S. Embassy in the secure communications room, Bolin was getting good news from Kurtzman via his satellite video phone.
Stryker, we can't keep plundering French military records. We're risking a lot. Busting into Suriname's military database would be one thing, but France is a very modern country with some of the most sophisticated technology in the world. In some areas of technology, France is even ahead of us. And right now, in all honesty, I cannot guarantee you that we're getting in and out undetected, much less what kind of electronic tracking and countermeasures we may be subjecting ourselves to. If French military intelligence catches a whiff of us and goes on war footing, it's not out of the realm of possibility that they could find us in spite of our firewalls and back doors. The risk may soon be too great.
Okay, but what have you got?
Well, there are some small hitches with the translation programs. The French Foreign Legion is kind of archaic in its military terminology. It's also kind of tribal and has a lot of its own slang. Akira's working on it, and...
And what have you got, Bear?
I got a French Foreign Legion Corporal Key Gannon. Corporal in the Foreign Legion is a lot closer to Sergeant in the U.S. or British military as far as authority and responsibilities than what we think of as a corporal.
Anything else?
He's active Legion and didn't change his name when he joined up. He joined the 2nd Parachute Regiment and made it into the Deep Reconnaissance Commandos, the Legion's best of the best.
Bolin consulted his map.
The 2nd Parachute Regiment is stationed in Corsica. What's our boy doing in South America?
He's a certified hand-to-hand combat and commando instructor. It seems he was transferred as a specialist to the 3rd Infantry Regiment and the Jungle Warfare School in French Guiana.
Interesting. But if he's active with the 3rd Infantry Regiment, what's he doing here in Suriname?
Well, his current post is less than 100 miles from where you are now. What he's doing on the wrong side of the Moroni River, we don't know. He could be AWOL, or he could be there with permission. Of course, Suriname and French Guiana do have a disputed border area. He could actually be there on some kind of mission. And that would take a great deal more probing of heavily secured French military files.
Just do what needs to be done. Hit and get when you feel someone tracking you.
Stryker, do you have anything to directly tie the French military to terrorist actions taken by Al-Qaeda?
No. All I've got are my instincts. And they're going off like fireworks on the 4th of July on this one.
Well, that's good enough for me, Stryker. You know that.
Bear, something really nasty is coming down the pipe.
So what are you going to do?
I'm going to go to French Guiana and poke around.